Good evening. I'm so glad you could make it. I'm Terry Thornton, curator of education here at the Modern, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. Tonight we have something a little different. In conjunction with the joint exhibition retrospective David Bates, organized by the Modern's director, Dr. Marla Price, and director of the Nasher Sculpture Center, Jeremy Strict, the much-loved artist David Bates is in conversation with Tyler Green of Modern Art Notes fame for a live audience taping of an episode of the MAN Man podcast. So while you, as the Tuesday evening audience, has always been, you know, you've always played an active role in these lectures, tonight it might be even more pronounced. Since the podcast is an introduction of sorts, I will limit my introduction to the simple remarks that we are so fortunate to know David Bates and to have him living and working in our community, which is a decision that David made many years ago after a stint in New York where he attended the Whitney Independent Study Program on scholarship before returning to SMU, where he was also on scholarship, and where he, after having received his BFA, decided to go on and pursue his MFA, taking a good deal of art history courses, teaching and working in his Dallas studio. Throughout the years, New York has been a destination for David, as he has been represented by commercial galleries there and has had various museum exhibitions, including the 1987 Whitney Biennial. But DFW is his home. In Dallas, as most of you know, or most of you are aware, David's work is represented by Tally Dunn Contemporary Art. And just an FYI, I've learned that we can hear David yet again on Thursday in conversation with Chris Boyd on KR's Think program. So I invite you to tune into that. Tyler Green, of course, comes with his own credentials as a Washington-based art journalist who edits and writes Modern Art Notes, is a U.S. columnist for Modern Painter and has been the subject of stories in famed publications with the Wall Street Journal calling Man, Modern Art Notes, the most influential of all visual arts blogs, also stating that you won't find a better informed art writer than Tyler Green. The Washington Post named him one of Washington's 14 young and influential cultural figures. The Modern Art Notes podcast, which is the format of tonight's presentation, is the most listened to audio program on art in the United States. It is distributed each Thursday through various means, including the site manpodcast.com. We are fortunate to have Tyler and David here tonight as they visit and discuss the work seen in each beautiful installation of the exhibition David Bates, paintings, drawings, and reliefs here at the Modern, and sculptures and drawings at the in Dallas at the Nasher. So before turning it over to David and Tyler, please join me in giving them a warm welcome.
Thanks for coming. If you want a double dose of David on Thursday, not only will he be on KERA, but that is when the episode of the Man podcast we're about to tape will be available. You can subscribe if you don't already on iTunes, SoundCloud, RSS, Stitcher, Downcast, wherever you get podcasts. We do shows every week, not always live like this. This is a special treat. So let's get started. David Bates, thank you for welcome to the Modern Art Notes podcast.
Absolutely. Good to be here.
Let's start with something you and Modern curator Michael Opping discussed in the catalog. You told him that you don't make much distinction between portrait painting and landscape painting, which is, I had to sit and think about that, and I still didn't get very far. So why not, or perhaps how not?
Well, I think that the way I look at them is that they're both very specific, handled in a very specific way. And so if it's a Well, I'd say that they start off like a portrait is usually somebody I've seen. They usually didn't sit for me. And I would look at them sort of out of the corner of my eye and make notes and sort of, you know, do little drawings back at the car, so that there's a lot of memory involved in both subjects. But they're both very specific in terms of my structure of how I want them to go. And so to me, that if it was a still life, particularly I think even still life seems even more portrait-like. It's a very, it's set up even like a portrait, the still life is. But all those various genres are things that I've always, traditional genres that I've just always loved since studying them in art history classes early on all the way through.
Well, let's talk a little about art history for a moment. I think of your paintings and your sculpture as being really muscular, is fitting within a very kind of beefy modernism, whether it's the landscape, say, of Grassy Lake or paintings with figures in them. And I wonder if that kind of muscular, beefy intent comes from what you see, whether it's a landscape or a figure, or whether there's kind of a certain tradition of muscular painting like Courbet's Stonebreakers or Hartley's Fisherman that took you in that direction.
I think choosing subjects that would go with a rough style that... remember when I was at the Whitney, Alex Katz came in and he said, okay, you have to develop a style. You have to figure out what your style is. Really come up with a style. And
he did.
And he did. And I thought, well, the only style I have is just a culmination of all the things that are inabilities, really. I mean, they just seem to be... there's no other way I can do it. But choosing the subjects, at least I can aim that roughshod look at the subjects. So if it's a calm stream in the mountains, that may not be as interesting to me as a waterfall. Or if it's giant waves hitting rocks, that's probably more interesting than just a surf coming in. And the tougher, rougher people, some of the subjects of snake handlers and whatever, I think those were chosen for that reason.
So, in, for example, surf hitting rocks or fishermen, your primary point of interest was your real life experience with those people, or, you know, you would see, say, you know, something in Hartley and then think, wonder what I can do with that.
I think what I did is I had a very traditional background, very traditional education in painting and art history. And it wasn't much, it wasn't very, very forward thinking. It was mainly backwards thinking. And so I think that kind of thing always led me to more traditional paintings all through history. And they enter in your head. And then as you find a subject, and I usually like subjects of those, Cezanne-like subjects or post-impressionist subjects of people, just working people. And they seem to be, it seemed to be not as, you know, anything too fancy. And that, again, worked with the style that I particularly have.
Because that muscularity is in your sculpture, too. I mean, over at the Nasher, Black Magnolia, which is a fairly recent sculpture, is, you know, the butchest magnolia flower anybody's ever seen.
Right.
Could you talk a little bit about, you've painted magnolia flowers for years. Could you talk a little bit about translating a magnolia flower from two dimensions into three, and if somewhere in that process, that's where it got butched up?
I think what happened is I started painting magnolias in 85, and I realized that it was really helpful for me to paint them, and they're beautiful, and they're always around where I live. So, every year I would pick a magnolia because they just smell good. I want one around in the studio. But every year I would do something different, you know, in my work, but the magnolia was always the same. And so I could kind of chronicle what I was doing through that those paintings. Those would be this constant, and then I would do different things with them. And I really never knew where that was going. I have no idea what was going to happen next, really, in working. But sometimes it would be sculpture. I also am quite aware that there's been a lot of really bad magnolias painted.
And some really great ones, though. But yeah.
There have been some great
some
ones.
Really famous
but,
great
but
ones.
But when you know, like sunflowers, when you decide to paint sunflowers, you're quite aware of Van Gogh's sunflowers. But then you're also aware of many other sunflowers that were not quite as good as that. And you know, you'll see them at garage sales and... the thing is that I just thought they were beautiful, and I think sometimes the choices of my subject matter has been held against me a little bit for that reason. But the thing is, I loved it. It wasn't going to deter me from it.
Do you think of Black Magnolia as being
one of the butchest magnolias
ever? Yeah, do you think of it that way, or am I, is that just me?
Well, it is. You know, first off, magnolias are so soft and so beautiful and so white, you know.
Yeah.
And to have the...
And it traditionally been painted that way, or
right,
portrayed that way in art. Yeah, that's been emphasized.
And to have the one I think you're talking about, that sculpture was worked on for a number of, you know, a week or so, with lots of plaster and metal armature and all, and it just got out of hand, really thick and sort of horrible. And one day, I say, this never works. It worked this one time. I came in with this Japanese hatchet that somebody had lovingly guided me to, and I used it on plaster and metal armature. It was a woodworking tool. But I just hacked the crap out of that thing. I just beat it down. I just beat on it until at a certain point in the beating, it all of a sudden looked like that. That really never happens. But in this case, and so sometimes in frustration, you know, my wife always used to say, you know, when things aren't going well, you don't need to sit around in here and look at me. You need to go stay out there and keep hacking at it and see what happens. And I think sometimes that kind of frustration will get you to that point, and something will happen that you weren't counting on. And that's why you can never count on what's going to happen. I never know where it's going to go for that reason.
So the drawings related to the sculpture that are also up at the Nasher, did they precede the hacking, or...?
They did. And well, there was some... Sometimes I'd do some before and after, kind of like a CSI crime scene. But usually before, and I think probably drawing for me, everything starts with the drawing. It's the most essential. It's the freshest the subject's ever going to be. When you first see it, you're usually the most excited at that moment, least jaded about whatever it is and where it's going to go, and how it's going to end up. And the more that you paint on it or sculpt on it, the more that freshness is going to go away or can. And I really try to always keep as much of that in as possible. Try to keep that architectural strength of a drawing, but have it still have freshness to it.
It's the magnolia drawings over at the Nasher that have the most pentimenti, the most kind of physical working of anything in either show.
The thought process. You can really see it.
Yeah.
And I think in those plaster heads, those seem to be, I only did a few of those, but they seem to be the most like what it, if you were a non-art person and you looked at those, that would be as close to the creative process of making a sculpture as that you might experience.
Is there any relationship between what you do with plaster and one of the plaster heads and how you treat, handle, use oil paint? Because it looks like a pretty different process.
I think that...
Like, there's some splatter with the plaster and, you know, some drips and all that, and your paintings are really tight and finished and done and confined, whereas it seems like there's a little more openness in the plaster heads.
It does, way more. And that's what sculpture does for me, I think, because I think that there's a, I don't know whether it's a attention deficit disorder or whatever the problem is, but I think for me, I work on paintings and they look finished like that, and then at a certain point, I need to do something, go somewhere else, and it goes into sculpture or into a wood configuration or drawings. Anytime things get stale, I just start drawing.
You are by no means the first painter to find sculpture irresistible. Is that more or less why?
I love the materials. I love the materials. The paint, I think at one point the paintings got so thick, about 92, that it was kind of ridiculously thick. And I thought, well, we'll do some cardboard reliefs because that's all I knew how to do. That's my finesse in sculptural abilities was cardboard. And so I, you know, went to a foundry and they said, well, we can cast anything that'll burn out into a sculpture and you can paint that if you want to. That's exactly what I did. And then it quickly went to those plaster heads. I was there like a few months and it went from materials, anything that will burn, wood, wax, paper, plastic, anything that will burn away, we can use that and make sculptures out of it. So I was making drawings basically out of those materials in 3D, cast in bronze, and then I'd paint them or not. And wasn't long before, just getting into that plaster and metal armatures and all that kind of stuff was fascinating to me. So it's really about the materials. I love the materials.
One of the pieces in which you most play with materials is, it's not quite a painting, it's not quite a sculpture, I don't quite know what to call it. It's Catalpa or Catalpa, mm-hmm. Branch. Help, how do you?
Catalpa.
Catalpa, from 2001. It's not a relief like the real relief pieces in both shows. It's kind of a collaged painting full of kind of witty references to itself and things that painters and sculptors have traditionally done. It seems like a piece that's kind of half making a lot of clever comments on art history and half about the flower and the plant. And I wonder where that piece fits within your narrative of it's not quite a painting, it's not quite a sculpture. Where exactly... Which side of your interest does that come out of?
I think that particular piece is probably the best example of what we were just talking about, of a painting turning into a sculpture or a relief. It was before it really the materials of wood or plaster or something really took on.
And fabric.
And fabric. Space. Yeah, it was like everything but paint and then painted. And there were relish dishes and all kinds of stuff I would find in Walla Walla at antique stores. And, you know, the kind of references that you have to art history in paintings, you know, that there's a painting called Galveston. It's the painting with the surf fisherman with a fish in his hands and a straw hat on. It really,
Galveston
to me, when
Bay,
I...
Galveston Bay. 1989, it's in Yale's Thank collection. You. We'll have images on Modern Art Notes on manpodcast.com.
Thank you.
It's at the top of the stairs here at the Modern.
Thank you. That one, it was a Piero, in the Resurrection Piero painting. There's a figure in that wearing a helmet. And I painted that picture of that particular guy, but by the time I got back to the studio and all the information in your head starts whirling around and you're painting that, it ended up being that painting. Now it's a guy with his shirt off in the Gulf with a fish, so most people wouldn't make that reference. But the thing is that quite often there's a Goya pose, the shark line picture, sort of a Goya madman pose that's in that painting. There's stuff that's all around in them, and sometimes they were intentional and sometimes they weren't. But you know, I always wanted the work to be accessible enough that it wouldn't matter.
We'll come back to Catalpa Branch in a moment, but seeing as you've brought up Galveston Bay, it's a great example of the way you build figures, most if not always male figures, out of rectangles, where the torsos are very rectangular. It's such kind of a thing in your work that it sometimes migrates into your paintings of birds, like the great night heron that's in the Modern Zone collection that's in the first gallery of the show. Why do men have rectangular torsos and bodies? How did that happen?
I think it's the architecture of the painting. And I think
so it came out of the two-dimensional space and working within the rectangle of the painting.
Right. It's somebody said during the show, seems like there's an awful lot of guys with their shirts off.
There are.
And I said, well, you know, like in the Matisse paintings, he wouldn't put so many clothes references that would link it to a particular time. So that even though you can't escape your time just because of the way it's painted, no matter what you do within a particular time, it's there in the way you do it. But I was trying to make them universal as I could. And I was not trying to do Galveston Bay. I would hope that it might even stretch down the coast, the whole coast, or maybe even Chesapeake Bay. I don't even know. You know, I mean, really, they're about people working the water and the figure and landscape more than anything.
Are you conscious of that kind of rectangle being there in a night heron and being there in a painting like Ed Walker Cleaning Fish, where, you know, his arm might be raised, but his upper half is this dominant, powerful, really physically imposing kind of rectangle?
I think it's probably just in composing a composition. I mean, I always really want to try to get... It always comes from a subject. It always starts with that catalpa you were talking about. They have leaves that are giant, huge leaves, and these big dagger-like beans that are maybe 2 feet long on them.
That hang down.
Yeah. And so it usually always starts with the subject, and then it either gets embellished by my memory of it when I get back to the studio, or it just needs to be for the painting or sculpture.
Because there's a real temptation as an art history guy to see a lot of Marsden Hartley in those rectangles, because Marsden Hartley's paintings of men, especially closer to the end of his life in the 40s, like the painting of his that is his version of Cézanne's Bather, are these just monumentally kind of wooden rectangular torsos.
That painting. I think, again, when I was in school, people would see that I was challenged in terms of doing Ang or Degas-like drawings, and so they said, you might want to look at Hartley or caveman art. The cave painters were very similar to you in lots of ways. Very direct, grabbed some stuff up out of the fire, started carving around the wall. Y'all see that bison? And some of the other people didn't see the bison until you outlined it. You know.
So you didn't know about Hartley before a professor pointed you and...
No. I think, again, in school, they would always give you a big general thing. But those guys, the American Modernists, I think, a lot of Texas artists before me were interested in that whole regionalist period. And so that Hartley and that whole school of people work out in New Mexico would have been of interest. But sometimes I'm hard-headed until somebody can point it out why I really need to know that, a piece of information. It'll go past me, and then say, no, this is... You need this, and then I'll get it.
If the most prominent way Hartley pops up in your work, at least the closest to kind of a one-to-one way, is in the construction of bodies, probably the second clearest way is in the way you paint breaking water. Water as it hits rocks. I'm thinking of a painting like Shark Line in 1990, which has this wave hitting a rock behind a fisherman that has just a remarkable amount of painterly force. when you were doing, and you did a number of paintings of fishermen and of the surf breaking around them, did you specifically look at Hartley for those?
Sure. It would have been a painting manual. I think I have several, you know, several people's books that are in my studio that I would occasionally look at as a painting manual. That Hartley book, one of those first Hartley books, is pretty covered in paint from me thumbing through that. And you always, you know, Picasso said that you try to do somebody else's work, but you mess it up because you're not them. And the part that and the part that you don't get right, the messed up part, is you. That's your deal. And so, really, I was no better at doing paint, drawing like Degas than I was Hartley. It's just that it was a little closer, and I could feel, I could understand that. I could understand what he was doing.
The physicality to the paint.
But, you know,
it didn't exist in American art before that.
Right. But, and something about American art to me is that, to me, is that American modernists seem to epitomize that sort of strong, forceful, direct, not a whole lot of finesse. I mean, Pollock, there's tons of examples in all different forms of contemporary art, but it always seems to look, that's what makes it all look American.
Those John Marin watercolors are not
awesome.
Like Cezanne delicate watercolors. They're scuffed and marked and ground and erased and
so watery.
They're a whole different thing.
Yeah, I think that sometimes I would put more like a pile on white because I wanted to look more frothy, more white. You know, it was not going to get any whiter, but I just want to keep doggedly doing it.
It comes off of the surface, and somehow because it gets deeper, it gets whiter.
Right, right.
I guess the other painter I see in a less direct way in your work a lot is Max Beckmann, and I think the first or second painting in the show at the Modern is Jan's Magnolia, a painting from 1986. And it's a painting that pushes out and fills the entire canvas, leaves, branches, flower. It's out to the edges in every direction. And in Beckmann, we see that an enormous amount. And I wonder if that's... If filling that whole field was something you took from American painting, you mentioned Pollock, I mean, obviously. But Beckmann certainly did it too. And I was wondering, you know, when I look at a painting like Jan's Magnolia, it seems like you were really consciously getting everything in the painting to every edge of the painting.
I don't think anything goes out in that painting, does it? Doesn't it all? I think everything comes right to the edge.
Right. Yes. And you have many edges hit on every side of the painting.
There's an electric feel when you do that things, there's a lot of tension around the edge of them. And I remember, you know, there were whole schools of painting that were about tension at the edge of a painting. So, you know, that again, there are all these concerns that you think about when you're making a composition or a painting. But the thing I loved about Beckmann, and I used to see pictures of him drawing in class, and you'd have a model up there, and his drawing did not look like that model. It was crazy looking, but the composition was awesome. The composition was architectural. The composition was basically a cubist painting with a face and
smashed
and hands
up against the picture plane.
Yeah, flat, really flat. And the black lines, I've gotten a world of crap about black lines. And
why?
I don't know.
What's wrong with black lines?
I mean, it's kind of, again, it's that cave guy with the chalk, you know, it's with the piece of charcoal. I don't know, but it seems, I've just seen, well, that you're using that black line as a crutch. I'm like, I need all the crutches I can get. If that's a crutch for me, then I'm going to use it. But I just thought it was a demonstrative carving up of the composition, you know. And Beckmann, I don't think anybody did it more.
There's an awful lot of black paint and an awful lot of Beckmann's.
Yeah.
I mean, the only other painter who comes close
no apology
is
for
Hartley.
That.
And yeah, none. None. Beckmann uses more black paint than Picasso does.
Yeah, they're black and they're big, slashing, almost like Franz Kline use of black. I mean, just like that. And then the faces were not trying to be beautiful. And I think that's one reason I don't paint women so much is because none of them will sit for me. if anybody's ever seen a self-portrait even, and you say, Tyler, I'd kind of like to paint your picture. Would you? No, you know, I've got to leave town, actually.
But there's a whole gallery of your self-portraits.
Yeah, that would be the one person that'll sit for me.
But you look, you know, you treat yourself pretty well.
That's not bad. It's not horrible, you know. I mean, I think that if you look around those spaces...
You make your glasses look thicker. The pans. You push it down your nose. And...
like I don't need them.
Yeah. The other thing Beckman does a lot that you do is that you build, and you started doing this in the 80s, you build paintings where there's a really dominant vertical at one edge, or sometimes both edges of the painting. Sometimes it's a tree, sometimes it's a windowsill, and I wonder why you find... or found that a useful way into a painting?
It's to me, it's like control of the edges again. That if you, in fact, now I actually take 2-inch black tape and I stretch it around an empty canvas before I even start so that I know where I am. It's like I want to mark the area where I'm going to be working.
Where do you paint first on a canvas?
It starts off as a drawing, just immediately. If it's a picture of something, a subject, then it would start probably there and work its way out.
So you don't necessarily paint the edges first; you just get there.
Oh no! You know there was a guy that helped me in fabricating sculptures with me. He was like a guy that could really figure out how to make things stand up, which was a problem for me at first, and. That is a problem in sculpture.
It's a big factor.
but he said he was looking at a painting one time that I was working on, and it was probably a still life. They had these incredible sunflowers in Walla Walla and thistles, those Russian thistles that'd be like 15 feet tall, briar patch, amazing looking thistles, and I'd grab some of those and put them in there, and it was a portrait of that. And at the edge of one of the canvas, I just drew a line down, like, on the side of the, in the wall behind it. And he said, "You just made this go from outside to inside."
Oh yeah, yeah.
And for me, you know, it was as much that as it was. It was probably more compositional than it was that. But to him, who didn't paint. He just thought, this is amazing. You make one line. Everybody, my drawing teacher used to say every line should stand for something. It shouldn't just be a bunch of stuff going on. And he said, you made this one line, and it completely changed this from an outdoor sitting on a table in the outdoors to inside a room now by a line. That's the kind of stuff that can do. It's pretty powerful, those lines.
It's interesting. We were talking about Catalpa Branch earlier, and here's a not exactly painting and not exactly sculpture either, and it's the one with the least stuff going on at the edges and the most stuff going on at the middle. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on all over the surface. It's part of why it's a really great piece. But it's kind of like in that piece you extended your references and jokes in two dimensions across and then in three dimensions. And in terms of the painting on that, what are we calling it? A painting? It's not a painting. A relief? What is it?
I think it's anything it needed to be to make it look like
that.
A thing.
So there are all these kind of little inside art history references and jokes going on in this piece. There's corrugated metal that's painted, which kind of makes fun of painterliness because of the way the ridges are painted. The checked fabric in the piece both creates and kind of makes fun of flatness and depth. And then you were talking about the use of black and the way it referenced shadows. How much is that piece about kind of maybe your interest in Trompe l'Oeil and playing with those conventions of American art history that are more present maybe in your sculpture than in your painting?
They're way more present in sculpture because they're, I think, more playful. The sculpture is, can somehow when I'm working on a painting, I just take it very, very seriously, and it's hard for me to let that go. And then in sculpture and reliefs, it's much more about play and materials. And, you know, the kind of crosshatch lines is the way that so many masterpiece drawings have been done, you know, with little fine crosshatching, silver point. And, I use that crosshatching a lot, either whether it's made with a chainsaw.
Now, you use it way more in sculpture than you use it in painting.
Right. I think that they show up more in the later paintings. And that's because I was working on the sculpture and painting at the same time.
Yeah. There's one painting at the Nasher where the crosshatching in the painting is behind the floral still life, as if to just totally destroy any depth in the painting. It just pushes whatever might be a white background or whatever else right up between the branches of the painting. It's pretty much the closest you get to Cezanne, with the exception of the one painting here.
Yeah, that becomes just way more playful when sculpture and relief. Sculpture and relief are as close as I was getting for a long time with that. And then I'd leave painting in its own sacred area. And then I think in that group of paintings, they started to play more with each other.
One of the places your sculpture and painting talk to each other most is in snakes pop up in both. So asking neither specifically about painting nor about sculpture, why so many snakes? Is it a Christian symbolism reference? Is it a backwoods reality?
It's I think I grew up around here and going fishing and doing all that stuff at an early age, and I had some early events with snakes, like water moccasins and various poisonous snakes. So I'm not real friendly with them. I don't know too many of them have crossed my path for the better, but they're such a loaded topic. There are certain topics that you'll use, and there's a lot of baggage that comes with that. And somehow, either in the sculpture of a man handling a snake, it was about that struggle. The struggle of the man with the snake and the struggle of the snake not being particularly happy about it either, and life struggle. And in the sculpture, it was about the struggle of making that thing, the struggle of actually building that sculpture.
That's Man with Snake 3 from 2000 and 2001.
And I know it's not a very popular topic, but...
Snake handling?
No, just snakes.
Snakes.
In general. Have you held
a snake like in Man with Snake?
What's that?
Have you held a snake like that?
Not that big. Not that big. And not alive.
Because there are men holding snakes in your paintings, too,
right.
Kind of even as they're surrounded by others.
Right.
And then there are, of course, the way birds and
you
snakes
You only have to relate. Mishandle a snake one time.
Yeah,
and then you pretty much know you're done with holding snakes. And I had that event early on.
There's one other place that I wonder if I see a snake. And it's in one of your Katrina paintings. I think it's the Deluge 3. I guess maybe before I get to that specific painting, I should ask you to set up the Katrina paintings a little bit. The storm's just over and you're watching TV like the rest of us, and you get interested in the idea of painting the aftermath of the storm, how and when.
Yeah, I had been going down to New Orleans for 25 years probably at that point for business. Arthur Roger Gallery down there had been handling my work for that length of time. And then I'd gone just on other trips, like most people, I won't say that. I went down there, it wasn't always for the best reasons. But I was well aware of the food and the music and the people and the climate of it that made it different than everywhere else I'd ever been. And when that happened, I knew those places, and I might not have known the individuals, but I knew other people that seemed to be very much like them. And then, of course, everybody had an empathy for the mishandling of the situation. But I think that I just started painting them, painting little portraits like this right off the bat. I just had a feeling that if Picasso had seen Guernica on TV, he would have probably done that. He would have probably, and started painting that stuff. And I felt bad about it that I wasn't there. And then somebody reminded me about the Guernica thing or the Wrath of the Medusa, that, you know, the firing squad, painting of Maximilian, you know, that you don't have to necessarily be there to feel empathy for our situation and paint it. And I just started painting more and more of it, and then went down there, finally got a chance to go in after a month and a half of not being able to. And Roger had turned into a barrier runner, a barricade runner at that point, because he had his house. He never left his house. It's nothing flooded there, but lots of other people had horrific occasions. And the stories that were coming out of there were biblical. They were the most amazing stories I'd ever heard. And that those stories being, they just etched the people's faces who was telling them in my mind. And so that's where the paintings came from. And it was very tough to not do something with that. It was like a reporter.
Is there a difference in the paintings before you went and after you went?
Yes.
What's the difference?
Yeah, I think just color, really, the color has never been quite as bright, I don't think, after that. I think that my parents passing on, they passed on the same year in 98, and I think some of the works around that time period, including that snake sculpture, were pretty rough due to that passing. And then I think the second biggest thing that I'd ever had happened in my life that was so big was that Katrina thing.
The Katrina paintings are, I mean, many of them are portraits. Many, if not most, of the others have cruciform shapes, power poles that form the shape of a cross. Was that an intentional decision to include cruciforms?
Sure. It's a very Catholic town. The Saints, you know, the Saints football hat and the Saints, you know, the fact that it's the Saints.
Which is in many paintings, many, many paintings.
Yeah. And so it was just things that I could put in there to mark it. And again, if you got that, that's good. If you didn't, it would not diminish the effect of the painting, I don't think.
There are very few of the Katrina paintings in which the power poles, the cruciforms, are standing straight up.
Right. Nothing was standing straight up. Everything, including people's faith, was bent at that time.
So in the Deluge 3, which dates to 06 and 07, the cruciform on the right-hand side of the painting is cross-shaped, and then when it is reflected in the water, it becomes a squiggly line. Is that a snake?
Well,
intentionally,
you know, from what I heard, there was all kinds of stuff in that water. It was a murky gumbo of snakes and alligators and nastiness that everybody was having to parade through to get out of there to try to get out of there. So, I think that's one of the things I love about water is that there's a lot of unknown stuff in it, and particularly the ocean. You know. When you take a hook and you stick some sort of bait on it and throw it out there, like that shark line painting, you don't know what you're going to get. And that's true in that. It was all kinds of stuff in there.
So that wasn't consciously turning a cruciform into a snake in the water?
That's pretty snaky.
Another one of the, yeah, it's pretty snaky, right?
Also, the color in that, you know, it was a very odd color of that sky. And the whole, it was an eerie, the story of the man that's in that canoe, he had to bust his way up. He got up to use the bathroom, apparently it was a story. Stood in knee-deep water, went to his bed, then he went to his countertop in his kitchen, then he crawled on top of his icebox, busted through the ceiling, busted through the attic into the roof, and was up there and heard all these people, you know, in the city and rushing water, and heard a clattering at the side of his house, and it was that canoe that pulled up and just washed up by his house.
Did you meet him? Did you?
I heard this on TV. And he dumped it out and got aboard, and he said he couldn't rescue anybody because it was a small boat, and they would just sink that. But he was going to try to get out and get people to come back to where they were. That's that kind of biblical thing I'm talking about. You couldn't make that kind of thing up. It's amazing stories.
There are canoes in the Katrina paintings. There are canoes in your paintings going back to the early 80s. Were you eager to adapt the canoes into the Katrina paintings, or was it just there so you did it? That has to be kind of a weird relationship as you were thinking about it 25 years later.
Well, I think the thing that I thought about was that the water pictures and the Gulf Coast and all that, all the paintings before had been very fruitful people working the water for the common good, and that they were all, everybody, it was a you know, if you've been eating shrimp, it probably came from down there. And it was all this workforce that works that water all the time, and we all live by it. It's how the life is sustained. Or you take that same coast and you throw a really bad hurricane on it, and it kills everybody, and people carrying their entire life out of that in a garbage bag. And that was what was, I think, so interesting about the hanging of that particular room.
You did a really large, major triptych after Katrina called The Storm. It's really unlike anything you've ever done. And it's really unlike anything that gets painted a lot now. It's kind of, you know, the closest art historical parallel is like James Ensor's Christ's Entry into Brussels or something, where you have this kind of crowd of people. How did that painting happen, and where does it fall in kind of the timeline of your Katrina work?
That was the initial, there was the convention center, and then there was the Superdome. And as you remember, they had a hard time getting people out of there or even getting water to them. Buses were all underwater and everything. It was a lot of bad things that happened at that point. And those were all the people who were waiting in line for when they did finally get buses. Those were the people who were waiting in line to get on those buses. And the looks on their faces were really appropriate to the situation. And I took a lot of stills. I had a lot of still shots from different photographs that had been taken, and then also just watching it. I taped a lot of that CNN coverage and just watched it over and over. But I think all those eyes looking at the camera, all those people, you know, they weren't all looking. But in this picture, I think a lot of people were feeling pretty guilty and pretty bad that they weren't able to help or do anything. And that's what that was about. I think it's probably 21 feet long or something like that, maybe by 6 or 7 feet. And it was not easy to paint those paintings, and I quit a couple of times just because it was too damaging, really, to continue it. And then I'd go back down there and see something else and then have to do that, have to work from that. And at the time, I had no idea what was going to be the use of these paintings. My wife said, you know, these are sort of horrific. And you feel guilty. You're in one moment you're trying to make beautiful painting, because that's what you've been trained to do, and it's of a topic like that.
And for the viewer, it's so, and probably for you when you were painting them, it's really, God, weird is an insufficient word, but, you know, in your earliest mature paintings in the 80s, you're taking advantage of the reflections off of water, people in space, canoes, and all of the same things are there in the Katrina paintings for a really different reason.
Right. It was a good times and bad times. It was when things were really working and things were not working.
Let's go across town over to the Nasher. The part of the show that's in the Nasher is in two places, the big middle gallery and then the downstairs gallery. Just beyond the big middle gallery is a collection installation. And I understand you were involved in picking some of the pieces in the collection installation, and I wonder what they were.
Well, first off, I thought that was very bold of them. Although, if you have a really good collection, you know, you kind of can't go wrong with that collection. Whatever you pick is going to look pretty good. But there was a Picasso still life that I chose, and a painting. And then there was a Picasso still life. It was made out of everything. It was a ceramic pot and plaster, really, and it's a little bit of metal armature in there. And then there was a black figure, a head of Picasso's, a female head.
1957 head of Jacqueline.
And it was initially plaster. And so I really could identify with that making a plaster head in that sort of monumental chunkiness. And then, of course, any Matisse reclining nude. They're also beautiful.
It's interesting to me that you chose the Picasso head of Jacqueline, because I see like a lot of Picasso in your sculpture and not nearly as much in the painting. And I wonder if that's how it works for you in the studio, too.
Somehow, this would be a good explanation. When I saw the Guernica paintings, and it was my turn to do Katrina, the freedom he had in abstracting that, he could do that. But I had a respect level that would not let me go beyond a certain stylistic abstraction of that subject. I felt like if I went any further in trying to make it stronger or whatever, that I would lose what it was really about. And I think sometimes in Picasso's things, as much as I love them and as playful as they are, sometimes they're more about Picasso than they are anything, you know. But in the sculptures, they were really about materials and form, and that seemed to be very, I could get that.
So you did not pick de Kooning's Clam Digger from 1972 to be out?
I like that one, and I don't know if they put that out. I don't know if that was a request or not, but I love the chunky, just again, the materials and all that chunk.
It struck me as a really great example of a painter who also uses a lot of paint, slathers it on,
yeah,
basks in playing with the stuff, and how his sculpture, you know, is very much a three-dimensional de Kooning painting, whereas your sculpture, totally different.
Right.
And whether, I mean, I know you got to see the Nasher collection a lot over the years before there was a museum. If you too were, if maybe you were struck by Clam Digger and de Kooning sculpture in the opposite direction, don't want to make sculptures that are my paintings.
I just really looked at them as really different things. And this was when you're doing this is how it goes a little bit. And like I said, if it's loosened up a little bit, it's taken me 61 years to finally open that up. And I don't even know that it's a mental block or what. I clearly like the other things, like the Clam Digger, but I couldn't really make the paintings. I think he was intentionally trying to make three-dimensional paintings.
I think he was. I think he was. I think that's how he kind of figured out how to work in three dimensions by...
It made sense to him.
Yeah, yeah.
And Picasso's, I don't know, they looked like folk art. His Picasso's, I mean, he was one of the first people who looked at taking handlebars and sticking a seat of a bicycle together and making a bull's head. Every folk artist would think of that. All folk artists. And the reason that they can do it is they don't have any rules. They don't care. They're not going to have a critic say anything about them. They don't know what criticism is. They were out plowing, and lightning struck them, and God told them that they need to make stuff, and that's what they're doing. And by the way, when I came back from the Whitney program, I really liked that kind of clarity. I really liked that kind of purity.
The folk art vernacular.
Well,
clarity.
It wasn't about an art business. It wasn't about when I was up there. It was about moving the. The modernism forward. That was your job. You know, avant-garde, your job is take the avant-garde ball and move it down the field. I don't care if you don't want to do that or not. That's what you need to be doing. And I was mentally not really set for that game.
It makes your interest in Hartley kind of all the more interesting, because Hartley was, with the exception of maybe 3 years right after, you know, during and maybe right after World War One, mm-hmm. Very early. With the exception of about 3 years, Hartley wasn't kicking the ball
right.
forward. He was really great at making Hartleys, but he wasn't an right. avant-garde painter.
Yeah, I just always felt like that in the land rush of contemporary art, as things were, you know, we got to find new land, busting new turf, new property, that there was a lot of perfectly good land that got left going to the, you know, like going from the East Coast to the West Coast, and that and everybody's faster than me anyway, so I just was like, this looks pretty good right here.
Yeah, like the new Hartley was doing was in the content, not in the way of using the medium or the...
I always felt like that painting, you know, it's died so many times, it's been on life support my entire career. And I've always felt like it was a giant, beautiful mansion with fully stocked with a wine cellar and all this food and, you know, whatever you want. And it was just left.
Yeah, painting's only dead if you're afraid of painting.
And I just, like, walked in and went, well, is anybody here? I'll take it.
A good time to open it up for questions. So if you have a question, raise your hand, and I will nod in your general direction, and then I will repeat the question. David answers it. Sir.
You know, thinking about Raymond Nasher and his collection philosophy, it's always struck me that he has certain things that he particularly liked. You know, the human figure... plasters, and particularly in this case, sculpture by people who are also very good painters. And the list goes on. And you mentioned de Kooning, Matisse, Picasso, Miro, a bunch. And you know, Raymond Nasher took a particular interest in you. And I wonder if you could reflect a little bit on Raymond.
So the question is, Ray Nasher was particularly interested in collecting the sculpture of artists who had also been painters. Did that motivate you to consider sculpture? How did that interaction with him and his collecting direction impact you?
I think when I went to his house, the only reason that I can imagine that he would have... I think that he saw that I was trying to make sculpture at the time. I remember one time I was... He came to a show, and Ray came up and he said, you know, David, I noticed that you are rather insistent on painting these bronze sculptures. And I said, I'm a painter. And he said, well, perhaps you realize that Picasso also painted a bit, and he left them in bronze because he used the bronze as a material to unify everything in the sculpture as a giant form. And I knew all that, but again, hearing it from him, you know, I thought probably about it a little bit more. And then, right about the time that happened, I think, my parents, that's when my parents probably passed on. And it was very easy to do a black sculpture at that moment that was very broken down and rough. So, yeah, he had something to do with that. He was always very supportive. No one ever loved, he was as much about a sculptor himself. His enthusiasm was like you would only see in another artist, really.
Yes?
The boats that you use in your composition are not like the boats that you would actually get in yourself. And because of the nature and the precarious nature of those canoes, are you trying to convey to the viewer that these are very tippy kinds of things and it's a dangerous act that's going on there, a balancing act?
The question is about the canoes that pop up in David's paintings and whether he's interested in the precariousness of moving a canoe through the water and translating that into paint and onto a painting.
The good thing about this question is the guy that asked it has drugged me around in canoes at that place. And he knows very well that they're very tipsy and has actually dumped me out of canoes. And nobody, this place was full of huge alligators and snakes and all that, and nobody wants to go in that water. And so I think one of the early rites of being at that place was that you got to go in the water. And so, yeah, I do think that the canoe, if you've never been in a canoe, they're not real sound vessels. And the smaller they are, the worse it gets. And if you're taking a vessel like that, I've been at this lake before with a 14-foot alligator that I probably had something to do with calling him over to me, splashing around, because I wanted to get a good look. And he's right there, and you do not want to be in a tipsy boat at that moment.
One of the self-portraits that's in the last gallery of the show features you in a canoe. What is on the bottom of the canoe in that painting? Do you remember? They kind of look like drawing sheets.
Oh, yeah.
Is that possible?
It. Yeah, that's it.
So do you draw when you're in a canoe?
That was my floating studio.
Do you that in a canoe?
Oh, yeah. Another thing is that I don't know that a lot of artists, I know that Winslow Homer did, but you know, I've gone down to the coast for a hurricane before. You know, I've gone to experience a hurricane. I just wanted to see what it was like. And have been, and I didn't leave because I thought this will be fun to stay. It wasn't so fun, but I think I like being in those circumstances because it makes it come more to life. All of it is very much more vital and visceral by the fact that you've lived it. You've been in those giant waves out on a jetty, or you've been in that little tipsy boat. And so what I would do is get a canoe and get my drawing pad and some beverages. And
there's a can of Bud on the bottom of that canoe.
I think there is, probably.
Yeah.
And go out and draw. Photographs always just look too flat and too distant. I would take a picture and it would look so far away. And also photographs would confine it to a very particular thing. It would be concrete. Mm-hmm. This is the way this should go. And between drawing and a memory of it, you could kind of recompose it through all those other compositions from art history in your head. Those would feed into the composition rather than just a photograph of something.
You know, the other thing that pops up in the canoes paintings again and again is the powerful stroke or the power of the oarsman and his use of an oar. Even in the Katrina painting where the oar is a bunch of 2x4s, that comes across. is that a compositional device because you get a really great diagonal?
Or absolutely.
It has nothing to do with
it. It is. It is. But it is also, you know, with one paddle, you can get, you know, you can really move that thing. You can turn it. You can do a lot with it very quickly, and that doesn't happen in many other things. It can be, I don't think I was ever very nimble with it, but it can be.
Only people asking questions are men? There we go.
I want to know about your application of black paint in your paintings. Do you save that basically for the end to make a punch of drama?
The question is about David's use of black paint in his paintings and when he applies it, when he brings it into the painting, and why.
The reason I wasn't ever very good at watercolor is because that's the first thing that goes on. Black paint would be the first thing that happens. There might be some underpainting, but really the drawing, it's always the drawing and the big black lines, and they get painted over and changed, but it's kind of the architecture of the building. So you get the architectural drawing, and then you know where the composition's going to be, and then you just put on the marble or the facing.
Is that the color you buy most?
Black? Oh, yeah. When I order black, sometimes I think the people online will, or when I'm calling it in, will say, what's going on in your life?
Is it always the same black, or are you buying different blacks?
There's two. Yeah.
In the back, in the middle?
There was more than just alligators, more than alligators and snakes in the waters. I have a number of cousins who lived in New Orleans, and when they finally got back in, they could smell it for miles and miles away before they ever got to New Orleans. Did you notice that, and did you try to put that into painting?
In the Katrina paintings, and when you were there, were you aware of the smell, and did you try to translate that into the work?
By the time I got there, most of the...
You got there about 6 weeks after?
Yeah, the water was gone. And I actually put the water back in because that was the most terrifying and amazing thing. But you could still see where the water line was. That brown line was very... There are songs about it. I mean, it was very pronounced.
It's in Richard Mizrock's photographs especially. Robert Polidori's too, but really in Mizrock's.
And the damage, all those houses, they were there for at least a year. Nothing moved. And so you got a pretty good idea of what happened, but I did know from the people who were there that I knew that there was a lot more to it than just what I saw.
One or two more? Yes.
I'm wondering about the evolution of your painting when you graduated in the mid-70s, evidently. And then the paintings we've been seeing, I think, started in about 1982. You had the courage to go to New York and show your paintings in the early 80s, I suppose, when everybody else was doing very minimalist kind of things. So you were up against...
And in black and white. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so tell me how you kind of found your voice, your painting evolved during that period.
So the question is how David's painting both kind of evolved during a period when art on the East Coast anyway was very not about painting and very much about black and white and a lack of color, and how and why he stayed interested in a lot of color and a lot of paint in those years. I think SMU, you finished 77 or 78, so just to give that.
Right. I think when I was there, I loved it. Everybody loves New York. I still go all the time, and I go to all my favorite paintings and all the museums, and the energy and the it was a priceless experience for me to do that Whitney program, because I didn't have that so much in my school at the time.